have a word of prayer and we'll look into our study. Our Father, we're thankful for the afternoon and we're thankful for the privilege of studying your word. And we are indeed thankful for saints that enjoy being together, taking the time to be together, because we realize that that actually is a very valuable thing for us to be able to have this time as saints and share together around the food, share together in things that you're doing, and talk with one another. We appreciate that. So we appreciate you making it possible. We look at your word this afternoon, the things that were going on with your son Jesus Christ in the first ministry. We ask you might give us clarity of mind as it seems these things so clearly and accurately for us. John chapter 8, and we're going to go back up very quickly to verse 31 just to kind of remind us where we've been, because we've been out of this for a couple of weeks here. And Ben Orth and I were talking a couple of weeks ago, and I said, you know, there's one thing that I've had as a desire in my life, and that is I would love to be in a setting where I can kind of sit sitting on the front pew upstairs by the piano. That's where I saw it. I just happened to see it coming out of the office, that's all. Anyway, I was telling Ben, I said, you know, the one thing I've always thought I'd like to do is be able to teach theology regular class. And Ben says, well, you get to do that, you know, you kind of every week. And I said, well, you know, the one problem with teaching it every week is you have to spend a lot of time, it seems like, reviewing, because it seems hard for people to remember from one week to the next what you're going over. But if you're teaching a class on a daily basis, then you go 4 days a week, it's back to back, things are fresh in their mind. They've only had 24 hours, you know, for the memory to get mixed up. So anyway, all of that to say that we're going to back up here a little bit just to kind of make sure, fresh in our minds, what we're looking at here in John 8. Jesus is talking to this group of people following the statements that had been made in the temple back in chapter 7, the statements regarding the woman taken in adultery in the first part of chapter 8. He's been telling these people, preaching to them. Verse 31, therefore Jesus was saying to the ones having believed in him, because remember when he got done there, it said there were many that believed in him. I don't think, I have a commentary to follow along with in John, and this is one of the things that these people wrestle with, are statements like this, because they think that he's talking about spurious belief, fickle faith, things like that. We're in John 8, verse 31. But I don't think, because of the importance of the idea of faith in the Gospel of John, I don't think this was fickle faith on their part. I think he was taking it very seriously. So John's saying here that Jesus was speaking to the Jews who were believing in him, that if you remain or continue at ease in my word, truly you are my disciples. Not all that believed in him would continue. So some of them wouldn't go on and be disciples and enjoy the long-term benefits. And he promised them, verse 32, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free, which we spent time looking at the doctrine of the truth a little bit as it relates to this. That an element of the truth is that God shows you how to have victory over the sin nature. Verse 33, they gave answer to him. Now normally, when you have a statement like this, and they answered or replied to him, normally the antecedent is going to be something back in the context you can find. And that is where everybody gets stuck in this, because they take it back to the people who believed in him. But if you remember, many of the Jews that were there believed on him, but they didn't all. And this response seems to evidence that these are not the believers. We've already been through this. They answered, we are Abraham's seed and have never been enslaved to anyone. How then do you say you will become free men? Now that statement about being Abraham's seed appears at this point to be a statement of physical descent. They seem to be stating on a physical level that we are Abraham's seed. Verse 34, Jesus answered, truly I say to you, that everyone doing the sin, referring to the sin nature, practicing the sin nature, he is a slave of the sin nature. And the slave, he doesn't remain at ease in the house into the age, but the son remains in the age. There's two possibilities there in verse 35, you remember. One of those can be that he's promising these Jews that they could actually become sons and remain at ease in the household. Or it could be that he's referring to himself as the Son and promising that if they have a relation or are related to him properly, they would be able to be at ease. One way or another, he's holding out a promise that their relationship to him, in one sense, can be different and not like that of a slave. That's what he was getting at. And as a result, they could be at ease into the age. If therefore the Son, now referring clearly to himself, and that's why I take the one in verse 35 really to be him. He's the Son that is at ease into the age. They could have such a relationship to him in that the Son, verse 36, would set them free. Then they would be free men, not slaves. And if they were free men, then they could be at ease out there into the age. Verse 37, I know that you are seed of Abraham, but you are seeking to kill me because my word has no place in you. In other words, verse 37, he acknowledges that on the physical level, they had Abraham's DNA. In fact, when he calls them Abraham's seed, he refers to them as seed in the context that they have received from him, a father's DNA, father's genetic material. And he says, I know that you are that. But he's going to change it, and he's going to say, I'm not talking about physical descent. I'm not talking about the DNA from your dad. I'm talking about ethical terms. I'm talking about how you function in your life. So he states in verse 37, I know you are Abraham's seed, but you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. The things that I have seen facing or alongside of the Father, literally, I speak. And you, or therefore you, the things that you have heard from your Father, those are the things that you are doing. Verse 39, and they answered and said to him, our father is Abraham. So now verse 39, they're not going to the physical descent as back in verse 33. Now they seem to be replying to his ethical descent. Oh, well, we've got Abraham's ethics. We behave ourselves like Abraham does. And Jesus says to them, if Abraham's children you are, then you would do the works of Abraham. That's I pulled this stuff up last night and went back over this just to kind of remind myself. This is what we call a contrary to fact statement. If you were Abraham's children, but you're not, you would do Abraham's works, but you're not. Verse 40. But now you are seeking to kill me, a man who told you the truth, which I heard from God, and Abraham didn't do this. And remember, when Abraham, which person of the Godhead did Abraham meet? He met the Son. You go back to Genesis when God came and spoke and met with Abraham. That was God the Son talking with him. And when he told him, hey, I'm the God that came and called you out of the Ur of Chaldees. In other words, when he identified himself as that God, trying to make the point to Abraham, I'm not a God among gods. I am the God, and I'm the one that's appeared to you before. In that context, Abraham didn't want to kill him. Saying, well, who are you to call yourself God, do this thing. He didn't respond like that. He's drawing a real contrast between the way Abraham responded and the way these people were responding. Verse 41, you are doing the works of your father. Therefore they said to him, we have not been born out of fornication. We have one father. And remember, they were bringing up what was still apparently a question about whether or not Jesus was the product of Mary's relation with somebody else. There was the thought that she was that he was the product of her relations with a Roman soldier. In fact, there are people even within the last century, the 20th century, that were still writing books and still teaching that about Jesus. That's going to be important for something we're going to see on down here in the context in just a few minutes here. This idea that we are born of one Father, God. Jesus said to them, well, if God were your Father, and this is a real strong present contrary to fact condition. This follows perfectly the form of a contrary to fact condition for the present. A contrary to fact condition for the present in Greek has an imperfect tense for the verbs in both parts of the condition. So what he says here in verse 42, well, if God were your father, which he's not, then you would love me, which you don't. For I have come out from God. For I have come out from God. I've come forth, and I did not come from myself, but the one that sent me. Why do you not experientially know my speech? In other words, what he's getting at is if you were really out of God, you should recognize what I'm saying. It should have a place with you. It's not just that you can hear it and know it as a set of facts, but you would experientially know that. It would make sense. It would fit. So that he goes on, because you are not able to hear my word. Verse 44, you are out of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father you desire to do. That one was a manslayer from the beginning. He did not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. You remember when we went through that, when he talked about him being a manslayer, it meant that he had no care or concern for how his actions affected anybody else, and as a result, if somebody else suffered and died as a count of what he did, no skin off his back. He says, that's the way you guys are. All you're doing is looking out for yourselves. Which, if you remember, when we jumped ahead to chapter 12 here in the book of John, we saw a few weeks ago that these people stood and said, listen, if we don't do something about this man, the Romans will come away and take away our place and our nation. What did they put first? Our place. They really were concerned about themselves. That's what they were worried about. And as far as Satan is concerned, it's not saying that Satan doesn't know any truth, but no truth, there is no truth in him. In the fact, he doesn't really function on the basis of God's kind of truth, of a real analysis of what it is. Because Satan himself should have been able to look at himself and say, I'm a created being and I will never be anything more than a created being. But what did he say? I will be like God. In other words, I don't have to answer to him anymore. I don't want to answer to him anymore. And I, in fact, will have others that will answer to me. That's what he wanted. So when he speaks the lie, that is that you can do it yourself and you don't need God, he speaks of his own things, for he is a liar and he is the father of it. But I speak to you the truth and you do not believe. Who out of you can actually prove sin about me? If I speak the truth, why don't you believe me? The one being out of God, he hears the utterances of God, the things, the articulations. He uses the word rhema. Logos would have the general content. If I asked Dan, say, Dan, would you teach a class on the doctrine of Christ? And then I've taught a class on the doctrine of Christ. We could both have the general same content, but he might articulate some of it a little differently than I do. And that's what the word rhema is talking about, is the articulation. He says, the one that is out of God, he hears the articulations from God. And on account of this, you don't hear because you are not out of God. Last Sunday over at Wharton, we went through not this passage, but a similar statement in 1 John 4, verse 6. 1 John 4, verse 6, John is addressing the little children, the little born ones, the spiritually young believers that are scratching their heads going, why did those people leave our church? John says, they left because they weren't of us, they're antichrist. Well, how come the world's listening to them? Because they're not of us. They came out of the world, so the world listens to them. And if they were out of us, then they would hear us. But since we're not out of the world, so they don't hear us. It's that reminder that, you know, when you speak the things of God, the very first year we were here in Royal City, I was invited to speak for community days in a community church service downtown in the park. There's a little part of Tim who gets a little full of himself at times thinking, that's cool, they're asking me. He's ecstatic. But then I had to remind myself, you know what, but I could talk, I could share the gospel. And I really kind of battled back and forth, but I thought, you know, my real responsibility is to the people here at this church. It's not to go down there. Because when you come to talking about the things of God, you got a lot of unsaved people that show up in the community that sit down there and listen to you. If you gave any message on biblical truth outside of the gospel, they wouldn't be able to do it. They probably would have come and thought, we're glad that guy's not our pastor. Maybe what they say, I don't know. But it comes down to that fact, that reminder that the world listens to people that are of the world. When you see people in the world get huge congregations, even if they're a believer that's doing it, keep in mind that they do that by making a message that comes out of the world. They have to compromise somewhere in the message. Verse 48, and the Jews answered, and they said to him, this is, and we had left off at verse 47, so all that was review, but we come to verse 48, and the Jews said, do we not rightly say? In other words, we've said this so clearly and accurately, our words ring so true in this case, that you are a Samaritan. Now, when did they call him a Samaritan up to this point? Well, there's probably two different things. One of them was what we looked at just a few minutes ago, where they said, we're not born of fornication, we have one father. What was a Samaritan from a Jew's point of view? Leslie got it halfway. She said a half-breed. My wife, I think, probably got it more closely. She said a mongrel. From a Jew's point of view, the Samaritans were mongrels. They weren't even just, they were worse than a half-breed. They were mutts. And remember, what did the Jews look at the Gentiles and the Samaritans as? They looked at them as dogs. Okay. They looked at them as dogs. And so that's really what they're saying here. Boy, you really are a Samaritan. Because a Jew would never say these kind of things. But not only are you a Samaritan, but they say you even have a demon. Now, one of the problems when he's talking about the fact that they're not born from God is actually an important idea when they make this comment. There is a little bit of historical evidence left that the Samaritans taught that they were descendants of Adam and Eve through Seth down through Abraham. The Jews, on the other hand, they taught, this is the teaching, now not all the Samaritans taught that, but this, some of the Samaritans, remains in a little bit of existent old historical writings, that the Samaritans thought that the Jews are taught that the Samaritans descended from Cain. And in fact, the Samaritans even went so far, at least some of them tried to teach, that Cain wasn't even Adam's son. That he was the product of a relation that Eve had with Satan. And that's how far that some of the Samaritans went in teaching that. So you can see here in the context, probably a little bit, even though the other one we know historically they taught a little bit of that, what we do know is in the context that they've already accused Jesus Christ of being a child of fornication. And therefore, in the context here, well, that would have made him equivalent to being a Samaritan. Yeah, your mom is Jewish, but your dad? And in fact, you even go so far as you have a demon. Because that's the only way anybody could ever say, we're not children of God. That's how sure they are of themselves. And Jesus answers, I don't have a demon. In fact, I honor my Father, but you dishonor me. Verse 50, but I do not seek my glory. There is one seeking and there is one judging. Who's he referring to? Who is the one seeking the glory and judging? Doing the judging? That's the Father. That was the one he was seeking. Christ was seeking his glory. What was the Father doing? He was actually glorifying the Son through the things he was giving the Son to do. The Son, by doing those, was glorifying the Father, but at the same time, it was the way the Father was glorifying the Son. He was the one that was also going to judge those people for the way they responded to the Son. Verse 51, truly, truly, I say to you, that if there is anyone that guards my word, he will not see death into the age. Will not see death. That word for see here, theoreo, means to be able to take your eyes and really peruse and look the thing over. You ever looked at something and you say, I have no idea what it is. I have any idea how it works. I drive down the highways and see these big wooden poles that stick up there. There's a crossbar on the top. There's a line. Okay. All very interesting. You go down to stands and stand now says, they run on those poles three-phase power. And he's explaining that to me. So now I'm driving down the road and I'm pointing out to Peg, hey, you see those poles? That's three-phase power. It's just like Stan. See, now I can look at them and I can analyze. I can see how those poles are set up and I can say, remember how Stan explained that to us? Now I can fasten my eyes on and I can peruse it and I can understand it, making sense out of it. It's not just three. I've always wondered, why did they run three wires on a pole? Well, it's because my wire in the house has three wires in it, a black, a white, and a... Totally different matter, isn't it? You know, Now I can understand that. Likewise, what he's getting at with this word is they would look on death with an understanding of death because they would be involved in it. We got to work on that one a little bit. So he will not see death into the age. Probably that expression at the end of verse 51, into the age, is actually a very important concept here in the context here, because when he's talking about into the age of sin, these are some of the things that Jesus states in the Gospel of John, and we may have gone over these, but I keep having to remind myself of this stuff. I figure if I'm having to remind myself, maybe some of you do, but in chapter 4, verse 14, you can do this, it's just a simple concordance study, but 4:14 he says they would not thirst into the age. In 6:51 he says they would live into the age. In 8:35 he said the slave's not ease into the age, but the son is. In 8:51, the one we're looking at, he says he wouldn't see death. In verse 52, the other Jews, we're going to say that for a second. Chapter 10, verse 28, he said that a person that would believe would not be ruined. They would not come to ruination into the age. 11:26, he promised again that they would not die into the age. So there are several ideas, promises, and statements that Jesus Christ had to say about things that were coming in a future age and how important it was for these people to know what was connected with that promise. And so his promise here is if a person really guarded his word, he wouldn't see death into the age. Verse 52, therefore the Jews said to them, now we experientially know that you have a demon. Abraham died, and the prophets. And you say that if anyone keeps your word, he will never... Now they change from the word see death to taste death. He will not taste death into the age. Obviously, you can see the reasoning here is you said, no, this would never happen to a person. But Abraham died. Are you trying to say Abraham was a bad guy? How about the prophets? They all died. You trying to say they were all bad guys? In other words, they're going back to the ethical issue. Remember this debate about whether or not they're Abraham's children started off with being physical descent. But the last verses about them being Abraham's children and then children of God hinges on their ethical behavior, hinges on how they're living. And their life does not line up with the character of Abraham or with the character of one that would be a child of God. That's what he's bringing into question. And these people say, okay, your question is that. Are you meaning to say that Abraham and the prophets were bad because they tasted death? Well, they didn't hear these words of Jesus that Jesus is speaking here in this particular context, for one matter. But it also was not that promise. He didn't promise Abraham and the prophets they wouldn't see death. He was promising these people that. Verse 53, certainly you are not greater than our father Abraham, who died, and the prophets who died. Who do you think you are? Who do you make yourself to be? Who do you make yourself to be, really, is kind of like our idiom would be, who do you think you are? Their expression was, who are you making yourself out to be? Verse 54, and Jesus replied, if I would glorify myself, then my glory is nothing. But, and this goes back to what we'd already referred to and said, that the Father is the one glorifying me, whom you say he that is your God. And you have not known him, but I have known him. And if I should say that I don't know him, I would be like you guys, a liar. But I know him, and his word I keep. In other words, he says, you guys claim to know God, but you don't really know God, but I know him. He actually, in verse 55, switches from gnosko, uses of that, you guys claim to have an experiential knowledge of God, a perfect experiential knowledge of God. By perfect, I mean it's a perfect tense. They knew in the past with a continuing result that they still know God. That was the claim that they were making. But Jesus pointed out that they don't, but Jesus says of himself, he says, you have not known him like that, verse 55, but he says, but I know him. And he switches from gnosko to oida, where he's saying, I have an absolute accurate knowledge. I've got all the facts. I've got all the facts and I understand it carefully and accurately. I know him. And in fact, he says, if I'd actually ever say I don't know him, I would be, you just got to love this phrase. How can you make a positive statement about yourself and insult somebody else at the same time? It's really what he does. And if you don't think he is, I mean, to call other people sinners and not children of God, I mean, he was telling them the truth, but of course they really took it as an insult. And what he says to them is, if I said that, I would be like you guys, a liar. You're being a liar by claiming to know him. I would be a liar if I claim not to know him. In fact, he goes on at the end, he says, but I have known him, and I not only have known him, but I guard right now, I am, present tense, I am guarding his word. Then verse 56, Abraham, your father, was glad that he should see my day. And he saw it, and he rejoiced. Verse 57, and the Jews said, you don't even have 50 years. Literally, the Greek said, you don't have 50 years. It'd be kind of like our idiom today. You don't even have 50 years under your belt. You know? You don't even have 50 years under your belt. And you say you've seen Abraham, or you've seen Abraham? Verse 58, and Jesus said, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham came into existence, I am. What was that acclaim at the end of verse 58? This is one of the best passages in the Gospel of John to demonstrate that when Jesus used the expression, I am, he wasn't saying, I'm somebody. I'm that one you're talking about. I am the Messiah. As there's some people that try to take. He was using I am, those two Greek words, ego, I mean, he was using them in an absolute sense. That was a title. It came right out of Exodus chapter 3. Let's go over and look at it again. I urge us to go back and review this. Exodus 3. Exodus 3 and verse 13. Remember, Moses has been tending sheep for his father-in-law, got into some trouble down in Egypt. Now he's run off there. Back. This is an old guy, by the way. This is not cartoon Prince of Egypt, young, good-looking Jewish guy out there in the desert. Remember, how old is Moses approaching by the time God meets him? About 80 years old. So, I mean, some time's gone by, so this is an 80-year-old guy. Not that an 80-year-old guy in their day might not. Anyway, he says there in verse 13, then Moses said to God, behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? In other words, I need a name when I show up. Verse 14, God said to Moses, I am that I am. In other words, literally, the Greek has, I am what I continue to be. In other words, it's not what I will become. I am what I am. I am, and I will continue to be what I am. I don't change. I'm an I was, and I hope I might be. Isn't that the way we are? You know? This last spring, starting the last December, I started running more. And I was getting up, I was up running 6 miles a day. And man, I loved it. I was feeling the best I felt in years. Oh, I was just having so much fun. Going out and doing that 3 or 4 days a week. And I pulled muscle. And I kept going on that, going on, until it got hurting so bad, I finally thought, oh, I should quit. So I stopped for a while. It didn't get better. I went to the doctor. The doctor said, you need to quit at least 6 weeks. At least 6 weeks. Now I'm looking at myself going, oh, man, it wasn't that long ago. I was running and I was feeling really good and I was losing weight and I was, you know. See, we're constantly changing. We can go from not so good to better, but down, back down, backtrack a little bit. And then all of us, by virtue of the fact that we continue to age, we go from being a place where, you know, one time maybe we could do this to now that I'm not as flexible as I used to be, or, you know, things like that. We're constantly changing. God is not a changing being. In fact, God doesn't improve. Mormonism, obviously, most of us, I think, are well aware of this, but in reality, Mormonism believes God continues to evolve and change just like they believe man does. Of course, they believe in evolution as God's means of creation, so they don't have a problem with that. But they think God evolves too. God does not evolve. The very nature of God is summed up right there in that name in verse 14. He's an I am. He doesn't change. So he says to them, I am, and he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, they took those Hebrew words and they translated it, ego, I mean. The very same words that Jesus spoke when he was speaking to those people and what John tells us about in John 8. The very same words that the Holy Spirit used John to record for us in John 8. Ego, I mean. I am. God is not a was or a will be. God is not changing. God is. So when those people asked, if you go back there to John chapter 8, when they asked him, wait a second, you don't even have 50 years under your belt. You saw Abraham? He says, before Abraham came into existence, he does not say I was, he says I am. Which sounds really odd to us, for us to read that, because that's a mind-bender to stop and think about that, but essentially, he not only is quoting that name out of the Old Testament, which is the basis of the name Jehovah, by the way, but he's also saying, the God I am back there before Abraham was is the very same one I am now. It's the very same one I will be in the future. I never change. I'm always the same. And they obviously understood that, because verse 59 says, therefore they took up stones that they might throw them at and cast them at. But Jesus hid himself, and he exited from the temple. Why would they have taken up stones to stone him? This isn't the first time, and it won't be the last. Over in John 10, he actually stops, and they take up stones before they get a chance to stone him. He actually asks, what good work are you stoning me for? Stoning you for a good work, we're stoning you for blasphemy. And when he asks for blasphemy, because I being the Son of God, because I make myself, and what they say for blasphemy, because you being a man make yourself God. They understood what he was talking about here. People today that go back and try to read this and try to fill in other details, because we don't, well, not us particularly, but people in certain situations that read the Gospel of John, they don't want Jesus to be of the same deity as the Father. They want him to be something different. They want to believe he was just a man. So they take all that away. They say, oh, these people misunderstood it. Jesus didn't correct them. Jesus didn't correct them later in John 10. He stands his ground on what he believes. They were claiming to be Abraham's children. Then they went on and claimed to be Abraham's children because of the way they lived. Then they went on and claimed to be the children of God. And he claims that you are not. You're not Abraham's children because you don't respond the way Abraham responded. You're not the children of God because if you were, you'd listen to people that spoke the things from God, but you don't. And then he finally can come down here to the end and he says, no, if you would guard my word, you would face death. They're going, oh man, you really are nuts. You're not going to face death. Abraham wanted to see my face. He was happy. In fact, he even rejoiced. In other words, the day that Jesus Christ showed up and spoke with Abraham, what it fills in is some details for you there that Abraham rejoiced there back in the Old Testament when God the Son appeared to him. Appeared to him no less than five times. We know he appeared to him in Ur of the Chaldees. We know he appeared to him in chapter 15. We know that there were at least two appearances in chapter 17. We know that there was at least one other appearance in chapter, no, I don't remember, it was chapter 21 or chapter 22 of Genesis. But we know at least that there were five appearances of God the Son to Abraham in the book of Genesis. At least five. And every time he came, he made some sort of a promise to Abraham. Abraham rejoiced over that. Who are you? Who do you think you are? And he makes that statement to him. Or we could put it, if you were to read it from a Hebrew perspective, before Abraham came into being, Jehovah. It doesn't have quite the same thrust, but it's very close. Jehovah's built off the idea. Jehovah literally is the one being. This one is a straightforward statement. I am. He's identifying himself with eternity. The book of Isaiah tells us that God inhabits eternity. That's where his home is. Oh yeah, God exists in the same space that creation does, but that's not really his home. His home really is eternity. God's home is outside the boundaries of time. Because God's not bound by time. Eternity is just a small, time, matter, creation is just a small point in all that is true God and all of that. Time is directly related to what? Physical matter. Remember your high school science when you talked about time and matter and atoms and speeding things up and the speed of light? And all of that is directly related to time. Time is fixed in this universe. He technically, God is not bound by time. God the Son. Even though they could see a human nature and a human body that was standing there talking with him, in reality, really what made him who he was God. Most of that is outside of time. They understood that. They understood what he was claiming. They disagreed with him. That's why they picked up stones to stone. Does anybody have any questions as we close this time here? If you want to mark these down, here's some other absolute occurrences of I am in John. We had 8:24, which we already looked at. We actually read through it in this passage today, as well as 8:55. And then if you look at 18, you have to look at verses 5, 6, and 8. Put it all together. Chapter 18, verses 5, 6, and 8. Chapter 13, verse 19, is the promise of a time in the future when they would know that I am. Chapter 4, verse 26, beginning with the verses 23 through 25, but 26 is the key verse. And chapter 6, verse 20. Now those are the absolute statements about that I am. Those are the statements in which he just said, I am, nothing else. There are a lot of others where he says, I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the bread of life. But there are some other I am statements in the Gospel of John. Those were the absolute ones. Any questions?